Good morning. Hawaii's counties want more of the transient accommodation tax, but key lawmakers want to see the revenue cap made permanent. That could happen with a bill coming up for hearing later today. We'll talk with Hawaii Island Mayor Billy Kanoi. And also from the Big Island and his farm, Neil Conan gives us his analysis of headlines taking his attention this week. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Rajiv Mohabir is a young poet who grew up as a perennial outsider in white America. His debut collection is called The Taxidermist Cut. And we'll have live Balkan music in our studio as Ernie Preventure and Kip McAtee of Partners in Time offer a preview of their Atherton concert.
It's Tuesday, February 16th. Stay here for the conversation right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Looking at the perennial issue of getting revenue to the counties, yeah?
Exactly, and this year it's a little more dicey, perhaps, in recent times.
Well, it's coming to a head, yeah?
You bet. And we're going to talk about that this morning. Now, in this first conversation, how you feel about what visitors pay in the transient accommodation tax may depend on what narrative you prefer. For years, Hawaii counties have said that visitors rely on the infrastructure and the services that the counties provide, and that they need more of the TAT shared with the state. A working group report released at the end of last year seemed to agree, but financial chairs in the legislature remain unconvinced and have criticized the report. Today, a bill to make permanent the amount of money the counties share will get an airing in a joint hearing of the Senate Tourism and Public Safety Committees. Big Island Mayor Billy Kanoi joins us now on the phone. Good morning.
Aloha. Good morning.
When we talked earlier this session, it was very much apparent that the increase into the TAT for the counties would be the centerpiece of what the counties were asking for. But given this bill was introduced by Jill Tokuda, doesn't that kind of give you an answer that this is going to be a really big fight, even more so this year?
Well, that's been the situation for the past 7 years now. Ever since the counties and state all collectively went through the Great Recession, the TAT has been a fight at the legislature year in and year out. That's why we have the current cap in place, because of a series of negotiations throughout the legislative sessions. But it's a big deal because the transient accommodation tax or hotel room tax or TAT is the second largest source of revenues for the counties who do not have the taxing powers of the state. All the counties have for revenue is property taxes. So yes, the TAT is a big deal.
The report that came out the very end of last year seemed to be making your point, but that was sort of roundly denounced by financial chairs and in the legislature, both Tokuda in the Senate and Sylvia Luke in the House. Are they just not able to be convinced that more needs to come to the counties, that in fact you deserve more than what they say is about, you know, 20% given their reckoning, that more like 80% comes from the state and therefore the state is due more?
Well, you know, I have a lot of respect for Senator Tokuda and Representative Luke as a finance chair in both the House and Senate. But it's very simple. The TAT starts to get convoluted in conversation. But the original enabling statute had three purposes. One was for the convention center, two was for tourism promotion, and three was to offset the impact on tourism on the counties. So that was the basis of the TAT. And then when financial difficulties visited both the state and counties, the state said, hey, wait a minute here. We want to take the TAT away. And then, we can't take it away. Then we're going to cap you. So all of this tremendous record-breaking tourism numbers for the past 3 years, all of that revenue has gone to the state of Hawaii. For example, real quick, we used to get 17 to 18 million TAT. If the cap was not implemented, the county of Hawaii would currently get 35 million. Now, when a state says we're going to take the TAT from the counties, it's not taking it from four mayors or from four counties. They're actually taking it from Ireland residents, because a TAT is 100% paid by the visitor. If the state takes it away from the county, the only recourse the counties have is to raise property taxes upon residents and property owners. So we believe that's just a fundamentally unfair transaction.
Meanwhile, the TAT has been increasing in recent years, including this year.
Correct. We're at what, $19.2 million. If we were under the old formula a few years back, we would receive $35 million. Now, for a county the size of Hawaii County, you know, that extra $16 million is a tremendous difference. That would be one of the largest transactions, largest revenue sources, period. Now, under SB 2987, we would maintain our $19.2 million revenue that we're currently receiving. The TAT working group recommendation, a working group that was established through Act 174 from the 2014 legislature, that formula would be $25.7 million. So, yes, we respectfully understand the finance chair's desire to have a lower number for the counties, but we would respectfully disagree for a number of reasons.
Mayor Kanoi, as the key lawmakers that we've been talking about have been poo-pooing that report, and obviously you've been making your case and have been for many years, including through the recession.
Right.
Is there any way out of this? Or is this just going to be, you know, knocking a wall until it finally falls down?
Well, I think it's an ongoing conversation. But what is irrefutable is this, that when a visitor lands at the airport, they're hit with a landing fee that the state collects, so state tax one. Then the visitor goes and rents a vehicle. There's a vehicle rent-a-car tax, and that goes to the state of Hawaii. The visitor then checks into the hotel room. Now, that's the TAT. So upon arrival, you know, over 8.2 million visitors to Hawaii, you know, all three, the minute they arrive, three taxes straight to the state of Hawaii. But what does a visitor then do? The visitor then visits the beach parks maintained by the counties. If they get in trouble, they need a lifeguard paid for by the counties. If they need fire or police assistance paid for by the counties, they drive on county roads. They go back to the hotel room. They use county water for shower, use the county sewer system for using the restroom. And when they throw away their trash and rubbish, that's county solid waste. So, you know, it's real simple. There was a tax that was created for offset the impacts of the counties. That tax has gone for many, many years to the counties under a formula that works. Yes, there were some financial difficult times for both the state and the counties. But it's like a parent and a child. Counties are the subsidiary of the state of Hawaii. It's akin to the parent breaking a child's piggy bank and taking money that was specifically set aside for the child. And so our position is, why would the state want to take away revenue from the counties that are paid by the visitor and then shift that burden onto island residents and property owners? It just doesn't make any sense. And yes, we have to go up, and we have to advocate year after year, but I'm hopeful and always remaining optimistic that the state of Hawaii and the legislature will come to the conclusion that this can and should be a win-win for the county, for the state, and also a win for our island residents.
Well, when you look at this year, Mayor Kanoi, does it look like this is not going to be the year that you're going to see that argument come to a positive conclusion for the counties?
That's a great question, and it's always challenging in February to predict or speculate what will happen in May. There's going to be, I'm sure, lively dialogue and some really tough questions from the legislature to the counties. We're prepared to answer those questions, and we're hopeful that when people weigh in, whether it's tourism industry, whether it's people from the private and public sectors, that the legislature will see that the TAT working group recommendation provides for everyone, because it was a very intensive conversation among all stakeholders, and no agreement gives everybody what they want, but we believe that the recommendation gives everybody what they need. And so we're supportive of that. We're hopeful that we can get there, but we're also mindful that, you know, given SB 2987, that if we're capped where we are, at least there's some predictability and certainty there for budgetary purposes.
Which was exactly their point, but as far as you're concerned, it's not enough and you're going to keep pressing, and we'll be watching. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me. Take care, you guys. Aloha.
Aloha. Billy Kanoi is the mayor of Hawaii County. The Hawaii State Association of Counties would like the return of more of the transient accommodation tax revenue to the counties this legislative session, but SB 2987, the bill we were just talking about, would make the TAT cap permanent. It'll be heard later today. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's now 8:16. Coming up, a poet explores shifting identities in his debut collection. First, your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, you probably know about the Hawaii state bird, the nene, and the state fish, humuhumu nuku nuku apua'a, but what about the state insect? Well, we have one established by the state legislature in 2009. The honor came about as a result of the enterprise of a group of fifth graders from Pearl Ridge Elementary who decided this insect's time had come. It's one of only two insects of its type that are native to Hawaii, with a Latin name that honors the Hawaiian monarchy. Its distinctive features are its bright red wings with sharply defined black borders and its 2.5-inch wingspan. As adults, they hover near koa trees and feed on the sweet sap oozing from broken branches. In their larval stage, they hide in a chrysalis that's well camouflaged, and they feed on leaves of the koa tree, venturing out to feed only at night. Can you name this resourceful arthropod? We'll be back with its name in the next half hour. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right will get a T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Makahiapo Cashman from the University of Hawaii at Manoa, Kapapalo'i o Kanewai. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
Poetry can become a very intimate form of self-expression if the poet has the courage to look inward and explore. Rajiv Mohabir's debut book of poems, The Taxidermist Cut, is the work of a young man whose ancestry and whose sexual identity made him forever an outsider.
My parents are from the South American country, Guyana. However, it is in South America. It's the only country in South America that speaks English as the official language, and therefore it's more culturally akin to the Caribbean. So when I talk about my identity, it's always through the veil of hyphens, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Being Indo-Caribbean, being from a community of Indians, of East Indians, brought to the Caribbean in the 1800s to work the sugar plantations. Mm-hmm. And this is the cultural background that I come from, which is a creolization of many different peoples that met in the Caribbean space, which was, you know, a cultural crossroads or globalized space before globalization happened.
Creolization that's an interesting word, but I know exactly what you mean by that. And it also speaks to the way individual identity, your individual identity, is shaped by history.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like this is the backdrop to my poems. It's what features prominently is my migration through time and space. I was born in London. This book takes place in rural central Florida.
Uh-huh.
And my kind of awakening into my body as a child, and being different, marked different, either
sure.
by like skin or, you know, queerness, etc. And so what I've done a strategy that I developed to cope with this was to escape into the forest. And so what features prominently here is the layers of history over the natural world as I experience it in Florida. So
I can imagine that Florida in many ways was a very conformist world to which you did not conform.
Yeah, absolutely. I was always the square peg, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, whether it was the way that I spoke, could be the languages that people would hear in my house, the foods that we ate, my smell. It was a very, we were isolated as brown folks in the rural community that we lived in.
I would imagine. And to what degree was that, you know, disturbing, hurtful?
Oh, well, you know, encountering racism in Central Florida is, in my experience, has been like very damaging in a way. Having your otherness marked having your otherness marked as something that is wildly visible to others is challenging.
Yeah.
Dealing face to face with these kinds of racism from people who are, you know, coming from very widely different places or walks of life, so to speak.
Well, whatever it is about that, Rajiv, doesn't seem to have dampened your spirits very much.
Oh,
right?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I was able to turn to the woods. I was able to turn to poems to heal this stuff inside of myself.
Yeah.
So,
which I think is the source of a lot of art, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. And our reaction to kind of the world around us is why we have that art, that space of art, which is, you know, spiritual but also psychic in this. It reflects what's in the psyche.
Was that refuge that art offered healing?
Yes and no. Yes, because I would be able to create the things that were different for myself. I was able to obscure meanings of stories that I wanted to keep secrets from my friends, but also from my family. And no, because, you know, the models that I had growing up were not necessarily, I couldn't see myself reflected in them. So the art and the poetry that really spoke to me was, you know, coded in song. For example, there's this Chutney master, or one of the forefathers of Chutney music, named Sundar Popo, whose creolization of various North Indian and Caribbean forms had really influenced my own lexicon, but then also my own idea or sense of belonging in a poetic world.
Belonging is a tricky thing at best, right? I mean, it can be, you know, the drive to belong can be limiting. You can find yourself, once you belong, you can find out, wait a minute, maybe I'm missing something, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, belonging is a type, can be a type of conformity, absolutely. And for, like, my family being migrant in for so many generations,
yeah.
The real belonging is in the migration, right? So, which means that it's necessarily fluid.
Well, yeah, because I was going to say, for you, conformity has never been an option, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like, never been in a society to which you could conform or that would allow you, in a sense, to conform.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that my connections with people have been really beautiful in this, the acknowledgement of this this inalienable fact.
But, you know, when I see it expressed in you, Rajiv, I see it as liberating rather than confining.
Thank you.
Is that a choice that you made? It has to be.
Oh, yes. This is something that I did in order to survive. You know, I used to pray to be white. I used to pray to be more like the other South Asian people, people who came directly from India, like the children of immigrants. I wanted to be something, belong to something a little bit larger, where I could see myself. But it's through, you know, understanding the fact that this migration is my fluidity can be part of how I, my interface in the world, I find it to be freeing in a way, that where my loyalties don't lie necessarily to spaces of conformity, but rather spaces where I can create beauty wherever I go, or human connection.
It occurs to me as we're speaking, Rajiv, that there are now untold hundreds of thousands of people forced into refugee situations where a number of people who look different and worship differently are going to be turning up in countries far from home with nothing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a, I'm not sure that that's a situation that anybody understands in its entirety, but you're in perhaps a better position than most to understand what it's like to be one of those people.
Yeah. Well, you know, the specificities of the migration of my family were not so dire or drastic.
No, I mean, I don't mean that. I just mean that a stranger in a strange land.
Oh, yes, yes. And so there are communities that are going to be formed. And this is part of the beauty of human migration, too, is that people survive. Like, we will survive. I've seen that in my own family. With the people that are the Syrian refugees specifically, when people have open hearts to accept these folks into our country, and into a space where they are able to carve out their own majesty and beauty, then I think something amazing will happen. Not just for those people who are reclaiming a sense of self or a sense of belonging, or trying to escape whatever trauma it is that they have faced at the hands of this vile oppression, but also it will affect the surrounding community. It'll be like the ripple effect, making, you know, the heart of these ideas of nation grow exponentially, is kind of like my rose-colored glasses.
And this is Rajiv Mohabir reading his poem Canis Latrans, which is the Latin name for coyote.
The epigraph is from Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth. He says, "The colonized tend to break into song. Do not mistake yourself for a wolf. Your plantation days of illiterate indenture still dusk the horizon. Crouch in the field of yellowing cane. Your ears and snout obscure your form. Your skin sings one song while people hear another. Your grandmother picks a book from the shelf and folds it into her bag. She takes it to market to wrap the fish she buys. You descend from a misread line of poetry that grasped a cutlass. You cannot change your hide. Your parents are not from India and only curse in Bhojpuri. Other Indians don't know your drawl and laugh at your rustic coat. You split from them for Skeldon and Lusignan. Here, everyone calls your camouflage a different name. Some jackal, brush wolf, some shudra or sand nigger. Americans fear you will kidnap their litter, drag them from jump ropes, jaws locked around blonde heads. They misread poverty for poetry. At dusk, cry these spirits into old Hindi film songs. They will clink as ice in your glass of rum."
Rajiv Mohabir is the author of The Taxidermist's Cut, published by Four Way Books. He's a doctoral candidate at the University of Hawaii who teaches poetry and composition.
Uncontroversial Supreme Court justice, who was also its most conservative.
"When I was confirmed 98 to nothing. I don't think I could get 60 votes today."
Antonin Scalia railed against putting politics into the selection of judges and warned it would just create a monster. The new monster issue for the 2016 campaign. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Once upon a time, there was a radio station that told important stories and told them well. Thank you to these station members who believe in Hawaii Public Radio and the stories we tell, Michelle Potts of Lahaina, Anthony and Naomi Bartholomew of Ke'au, and Andrew Jackson of Waipahu. If you'd also like HPR to live happily ever after, you can help with your membership dollars. Reach us at 955-8821 during business hours or at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. A lawmaker who has repeatedly criticized the University of Hawaii has ramped up his judgment of management. This year, House Higher Education Committee Chair Isaac Choi has an even sharper tongue and 24 bills some are characterizing as an attack. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Well, certainly UH is no stranger to the berating of Rep. Choi, but this seems to be above and beyond just a lot of criticism.
Well, I'll tell you what Isaac Choi says. He says it's not an attack on UH. It's nothing out of the ordinary, just trying to work towards the success of the students there. But when you look at some of the bills and the fact that a lot of them are opposed by the university, you wonder whether, in fact, there is a full frontal assault on the autonomy and the spending practices at the university. Let me give you a couple of examples of the bills that are running. One of them would require that UH get approval if they're going to pay anybody more than twice the governor's salary. And there are actually quite a few people, at least 10 or more, that make twice as much as the governor and well above that at UH. Another one would actually allow lawmakers to vote down tuition increases. And then there's another one that would take $4 million, cut it from executive salaries, and use it to pay grad assistants. I could go on and list a few others, but the feeling in some quarters is that Isaac Choi may be going over the top in his attacks, in his efforts to right the ship of UH.
But clearly what he's trying to do is take away that top layer and plow it back into the graduate students and into the school itself, isn't he?
Right. There's another bill that would actually allow graduate assistants to have collective bargaining, and that one's opposed by the university as well. Now, in support of Isaac Choi, there are other lawmakers at the legislature that there's a sense of frustration that, well, here's how Brian Taniguchi put it. He's Choi's counterpart in the Senate higher ed. He said there's a sense that UH has lost its way, that there's been all sorts of problems with the way they're spending money. Even Roy Takumi, who acknowledges that Isaac Choi's bills, and Roy is his counterpart on education, lower education, if we will. He says there are good intentions behind these bills to try and fix what they believe is a lack of oversight, poor spending practices, and other problems at the university.
And sometimes hyperbole is used simply to make a point. Any of these bills you think going to get any traction, Chad?
You know, it's still so soon to tell. It's only February. The session runs until early May. Certainly, we will see how things develop. My guess is that something will get through. I can't tell you. I wouldn't put my money on any of them right now because, yes, I've always said, never try and place a bet on what's going to happen with the legislature. But this much we do know. The UH is funded primarily by tax revenue from the legislature. The legislature is thinking, why should we give you more money if you're not doing a good job?
Exactly. We'll leave it there. Thanks very much.
Thanks Beth. Yeah.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us daily with a reality check. We're to talk about more of the news that may be taking your attention as well. Fighting escalating in Syria, an unexpected vacancy on the Supreme Court, and the campaigns for the presidential nominations moving into South Carolina and Nevada. News analyst Neil Conan joins us now from his Macnut Farm on the Big Island to tie all of these stories together. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning. It gets cold here in Hawaii.
It does, doesn't it? Especially where you are. And at least a little bit wet, but hopefully that's good news for you. But getting onto the news of Syria, a series of attacks on hospitals in northern Syria yesterday, dozens killed by bombs and those missiles allegedly fired by the Syrian government and Russian allies. This seems to be getting worse and worse.
Yeah, it does. And we should probably begin with two caveats. The Russians and the Syrian government say they did not conduct these attacks, and they blame the U.S.-led coalition. The U.S. said it did not have any aircraft in that area yesterday. Most observers believe that Russia did much of the bombing, and a Syrian missile may have done the rest. As for attacks on hospitals, we have to remember there can be mistakes. The U.S. hit a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Afghanistan last year. The U.S. infamously hit the Chinese embassy in Belgrade during the war in Kosovo, so even precision attacks can and do go horribly wrong. But in Syria, there is a pattern of these kinds of attacks by the government, hundreds of strikes on hospitals and clinics that are apparently designed to depopulate rebel areas or at least make them much harder to live in. So, you know, I guess the best guess is another horrible day in an especially horrible war.
A bright spot might be that there's supposed to be a ceasefire in Syria as of Friday. Is this, though, what we kind of see in front of ceasefire deadlines where both sides try to get their licks in just before the shooting stops?
That could be. But I have to say, at this point, that's the most optimistic scenario. The Russians say, you know, no matter what happens, they intend to keep right on bombing what they call terrorist targets. Yesterday, President Bashar al-Assad said his forces will continue to attack terrorists. The rebels are unlikely to lay down their weapons if they're being attacked. So right now, there's little expectation that fighting will even diminish, much less cease on Friday. And there has to be deep concern about the humanitarian side of this ceasefire that was negotiated a couple of weeks ago by Secretary of State Kerry, whether that can work now. That's the delivery of food and medicine to communities under siege. They're under siege mostly by government forces, but by rebels, too, in some places. And it's important to note that ISIS was not part of any of these talks, of course. They never agreed to any ceasefire. So, you know, right now, the prospects look pretty bleak.
Most of these attacks were in the area of Aleppo, a major rebel-held city where Russian bombs have been paving the way for government successes in recent days. We always say how complicated this conflict is, but reports are suggesting that it's even more complicated now than usual.
That's a good point, Beth Ann. It's so hard to keep track of who's fighting who and where and why. Now, according to today's New York Times, for example, a group led by Kurdish militias is taking advantage of those Russian airstrikes to occupy territory near the Turkish border. Now, this is a group that's supported by the United States. The Kurds have been the most effective group against ISIS. But right now, they're being shelled by Turkey from across the border. Turkey, of course, is another American ally, a member of NATO. Turkey vows to prevent any further advances by the Kurds. That could well mean more intervention inside Syria by Turkey. At the same time, the anger between Turkey and Russia is deepening, as the Turks believe the Russians are helping their worst enemies, the Kurds. And now the Saudis, yet another American ally, are threatening to send ground troops into Syria from Turkey.
Is that a real possibility? I mean, wouldn't Turkish and Saudi troops in Syria make things even more complicated?
Oh, yes, indeed, they would. Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov talked the other day. If Saudi troops go in, he said this could lead to world war. Now, this wasn't a threat. This was, you know, things spiraling out of control, a worst-case scenario kind of thing. And a lot of observers think that what Saudi Arabia and Turkey are doing is really trying to get the United States to take a more muscular role, to do something in their thinking before it's too late. Their spokesmen have acidly pointed to the Obama administration's, you know, long-standing position that there's no military solution in Syria. And they say, well, it turns out there is a military solution, but it's Russia's military solution, and it's leading to a victory by President Assad.
All right, well, for the moment, let's just leave that one and turn to a conflict where the talk of scorched earth is just a metaphor, but nonetheless potent for folks in Washington with all the political talk around the successor to Antonin Scalia. Now, the president says that he's going to make a nomination. Republican Senate leaders say any Obama nominee is going to be dead on arrival, and that we should all wait until after the election, see who's president. And, of course, all the presidential candidates have been weighing in. How do you see this playing out?
Well, we're going to know a lot more after President Obama makes his next move. The ball is in his court. The most likely outcome is that the Republicans are going to do exactly what they said they would do. They'll bottle up any nomination in the Senate Judiciary Committee while both sides use the issue to, you know, whip up their base. You know, Republicans charge that, you know, it's a lame duck president trying to capture the Supreme Court to foster a left-wing agenda on guns and abortion and gay marriage. The Democrats charge that Republican obstructionists are defying their constitutional duty for partisan reasons, hoping to turn back the clock on gay marriage and union rights and on Obamacare.
Okay, so whose name does the president send up then?
Well, that is the next move. Let's say he nominates a moderate. Republicans might think, he or she is no Scalia, but better than we'll get from a newly elected President Clinton or a President Sanders. So they may want to, wait a bit and see how the election is shaping up. So, there's an outside chance maybe a moderate nominee might actually get a vote, maybe even a confirmation, but that's a very outside chance. So does the president nominate a woman or an African-American or a Latino to raise the political costs, the electoral costs for the Republicans for obstruction? Or does the president nominate, some fire-breathing liberal, which makes, Republican rejection easier, but could energize the Democratic base? I guess it could energize both bases.
Okay, well, there could be a combination, maybe a moderate Asian-American, for example. Lots of people are talking about Sri Srinivasan or Jacqueline Nguyen as possible candidates, both federal appeals court judges, both confirmed by the same Senate just a couple of years ago, but both by lopsided margins.
Right, that's exactly right. And after, but after all the political tactics, we have to remember this is, a truly momentous decision. This next Supreme Court justice either locks in the conservative majority or swings the balance to the left. And we mentioned just a few issues: health care, immigration, voting rights, union rights, abortion. Every single one of those are on the Supreme Court docket right now. Now, probably the Obama nomination does not get through, and that makes the outcome of this presidential campaign even more dramatic.
All right, well, let's talk about that a bit. Last week, you got New Hampshire mostly right, certainly the winners, Trump and Sanders. What's your call for when we talk next week and Democrats will have caucused in Nevada and Republicans will have voted in South Carolina?
Nevada is just tough. There's so little polling there. Everything you do see suggests it's getting closer. But I think Hillary Clinton wins by more than she won in Iowa, which was not very much, but by a lot less than Bernie Sanders won in New Hampshire, which was quite a bit. South Carolina, I think Trump's lead dwindles, but Trump, Cruz won 2, Rubio, Bush 3-4, but that order could flip. Then Ben Carson and John Kasich trail, probably Carson ahead, Kasich rather, ahead of Carson.
Okay, Chris Christie, Carly Fiorina, Jim Gilmore, all dropped out. More casualties after South Carolina?
Hard to see why Ben Carson would stay in if he's way back in the pack. Kasich is going to try to hold on until the campaign gets to more moderate states. That's going to be a while. The big question is be for whomever does worst between Rubio and Bush. If there's a clear loser there, he's going to face a lot of pressure to drop out and clear the field for, the alternative to Cruz and Trump. So we'll see, but maybe not quite yet.
All right, Neil. Thanks.
Talk to you next week, Beth Ann.
You bet. News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from his farm on the Big Island. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio.
The news can sometimes be overwhelming.
Blanc said France was under attack.
A mass shooting in San Bernardino.
A police officer killing a child.
More than 2 degrees Celsius above what?
Total and complete shutdown of Muslims.
Syrian refugees here being put under a magnifying glass.
All Things Considered is here to help you make sense of it all. Listen every afternoon.
Weekday afternoons from noon to 2.
In today's backyard quiz, we talked about butterflies native to the Hawaiian Islands. Now, full-grown, the one we asked you to name today, has a 2.5-inch wingspan with bright red wings. Let's try that again. Bright red wings that have a black border. They can be seen hovering around the branches of koa trees, whose sap is one of this creature's staple foods. It lays its eggs on the mamaki plant, where it, still in the caterpillar stage, protects itself with an ingenious covering. A flap of leaf secured with silk to make a shelter. Their numbers are in decline, but there's a statewide effort called the Pulelehua Project to map locations where they can be found. based on information gathered from researchers and citizen scientists. The project was developed by researchers at UH, and that could be the least we can do for our state insect, the Kamehameha butterfly.
And Beth Ann, Kristen Mailhue of Kailua knew the answer. Congratulations to Kristen and to our state insect.
That's today's quiz at 8:48, and you can send us one if you've got one to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Butterflies.
Good morning, I'm Scott Cooney from the GBO Group. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The music of the Balkans reflects both its geography and its history as a buffer zone of sorts between Europe and Asia. Minor key scales, unusual rhythms, all of these inhabit the music of Partners in Time. The band is coming to our Atherton studio this weekend, and its leader and guitarist Kip McAtee and its bassist Ernie Preventure are with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Kip, it's good to have you. Ernie, it's good to have you here.
Thanks.
This is an exotic sort of obsession for you, Kip, and you've made quite a study of it, haven't you?
I've been playing this with Seren for probably 30 years now.
Seren being?
Seren Baronian is our clarinet player.
Uh-huh.
He comes to Hawaii once a year, and we work with him for 2 or 3 months, and I just try and copy him.
When you're coming from a Western music place, what's tricky about learning this type of music?
Well, there's the time signatures, and there's the scales, the makams they call them in Turkey.
Uh-huh.
And then there's the phrasing. There's like a different ethic to the music in Turkey and the Middle East. They phrase out things differently, and there's lots of ornamentation that are different. So it's like it's a different culture, you know.
You were playing me some examples of that, sort of comparing a scale from this kind of music to the scales that we know best.
Yeah, we have a tune we're going to play this morning called Hijaz Mandra. The makam is called Hijaz. Western music sounds like... our familiar friend, the major scale, but a Hijaz scale sounds like...
as we know from any movie that has shifting sands on the... on the screen, right?
Sounds like Lawrence of Arabia, right?
Yeah, yeah. And in a good way, for sure. But as you know, if you made a sort of a map of the world and had a touch screen where you would play the music as you know, of each area as you touched it, as you moved east, what would happen?
Right. The music towards Germany and France and England is going to sound like Bach and classical music, and then the farther you go to Greece, it starts to have a little bit of a flavor with ornaments and, you know, kind of things. And then when you get to Turkey, everything changes. It's like got a huge, very old classical tradition, older than Western classical music,
mm-hmm.
played on the oud mostly and the ney, and it goes back thousands of years.
Oud being a fretless stringed instrument.
Right, the predecessor to the guitar, really.
And as soon as you get into a fretless instrument, you get into the notes between the keys on the piano, right?
We can't play that this morning because I have a regular guitar today, but an oud can play just like a violin, any note.
Well, let's hear a couple of musical samples from...
Well, this tune, one? Hijaz Mandra, is in that Hijaz scale, and it's in a 7/8 rhythm, so the time signature sounds like 1-2-1-2-1-2-3, 1-2-1-2-1-2-3.
Thank you. That was terrific. Thanks, you guys.
Hijaz Wandra.
You know, Kip, in spite of the fact that that's a, quote, difficult time signature, as soon as you hear it, you know where to pat your foot. I mean, it becomes quite quite clear.
It's dance music. They call that the man with the crooked stick in the Balkans. You imagine a guy kind of walking with a funny gait.
That makes sense. And, you know, it makes me think how limited we are in many ways in the West, because I didn't see last night's Grammy Awards, but I'm willing to bet everything was in 4/4 time, and even minor chords were heard only rarely, right?
Possibly.
So this takes us really beyond where we've been all too attuned, don't you think?
Well, it's a color, and we like to encourage people to come hear our band just for something a little bit different from Hawaiian music and the things you hear all the time here.
Sure.
And it's a great, great honor and privilege to get to play here at KHBR. I've been here several years, and the room in there is, the Atherton studio is the best.
It's a great, you get a great sound. It's like a big, being inside a big guitar, right, with all that hardwood.
It's like being in a recording studio, really.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to that concert. Thanks so much for coming in. Great to have both of you on the studio. Kip McAtee is the guitarist, Ernie Preventure the bassist in Partners in Time, which will perform Saturday evening in our aforementioned Atherton Performing Arts Studio.
I want to just take us back to an earlier conversation this hour that you had with Rajav Mohabir.
Yeah.
And some of the, not just the poetry that he shared, but his own story.
And
the fact that was a conversation that seemed it could go on for a lot longer.
And it did. But at the same time, what it reminded me, among other things, was the kind of courage that a poet needs. If you're going to write poetry that is really personal, you really have to dig very deep and be unafraid of the result. And that was the thing I think that really stood out about him, was his candor about who he was, what it was like growing up in Central Florida, of an ancestry that nobody around him really understood, and then even finding things about himself that people in his immediate family didn't understand, and coming to terms with that. But using poetry to come to terms with very intimate personal things, and yet finding a message in that to which other people can respond.
All the while, as he said, praying that he would wake up white.
Yeah, that was one of the wrenching things about it. But, you know, and I asked a couple of questions of him that essentially reflected what I saw when we met, which is that he has a very open and cheerful demeanor. So, you know, I kept saying, you know, Rajiv, this doesn't seem to have damaged you that much. You managed to keep your head up and being a person of good cheer. It was a very worthwhile conversation.
Well, what's what that they say about the truth will set you free?
Exactly.
Maybe in his case it has. Good conversation. Thanks for sharing that with us.
You bet.
That's going to do it for us for today. Up tomorrow, we're going to check in with Tom Yamachika of the Hawaii Tax Foundation about some of those tax bills back at the legislature.
And we'll look in with the Vegetarian Society of Hawaii.
We like to hear from you. You can reach us anytime you like on our talkback line. Leave your comments at 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or you can tweet me at BKOZHPR.
Past shows are on the HPR2 archive under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkut.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning right here for more of The Conversation.